You know, there's a real dark time ahead for some children and families in need this holiday season. So as you plan your limited holiday...
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Russ Avison right here on LA Talk Radio.
We'd like to welcome you to another wonderful evening right here on LA Talk Radio's very own The Writer's Block. I am Jim Christina, and I am sitting here looking at myself on my computer and talking to Mr. Russ Avison in Fillmore, California. Hello, Russ.
Oh, Jimmy, good to see you. And I actually can see you now.
You actually can't see me. Yeah. So here, let me give you the salute, Russ.
Thank you for that.
Well, let me kind of finish up the announcement that was before. and it would be wonderful if you all could find out where local and your food distribution centers are, and take some food over to the food bank, or stop by and drop some off at the food distribution centers, because there's a lot of folks that are hungry, and their kids are hungry, and they could use a little help. So if you could do that, that would be like totally awesome and godlike. Okay, that's it. That's all I have. So thanks for listening, and we're out. No. We have hey, you guys have had some wins, huh?
Oh man, I'll tell you, it was well, just to give you an idea, our road down at the end where you have to turn in to come down here, was there was a big old pine tree laying across the other day, and you couldn't even come down here. Well, and today I just saw there's this little strawberry stand that I buy strawberries during the season, and they have this nice little like a tough shed building, you know, red tough shed building up on a concrete platform, and it was on its roof about 10 feet away from the platform.
Get out. Are you serious?
Yeah. It's a lot of stuff, a lot of trees down.
Yeah, there's, you know, when we lived in Simi Valley, of course, we're now up in my secret studio up in Sawtooth and Rocky Mountains. But when we lived down in Simi Valley, it was like the winds. I used to hate it every winter. Starting in November all the way through May, the winds were just horrible. Just horrible.
Yeah.
And I mean, my allergies are bothering me right now, but I mean, they used to be three times this down in California. So I'm kind of glad for that. And we actually got some snow tonight, so I'm pretty happy about that.
Yeah, we're getting rain tomorrow.
Well, okay then. So we're both happy.
A little.
Yeah. Well, that'll help keep the dust down for you.
Yes, indeed. And it's dusty. And it is really bad.
Yeah, and right, it helps keep the pollen down for us. It's been a really mild winter, so it's still, you know, the dust in my house is like yellow. It's ugly. it's ugly.
Sure, that's dust, Jim.
I know I'm not. We have a return guest tonight. She is, oh my gosh, she was here about 3-4 weeks ago, I guess. And we just didn't quite finish with her. She sent us a new book. We got her book back on the show. And she is like this aficionado on women of the West. She's a historian. She's a writer. She's a president of the Western Writers Association of America. She's all around great gal and a wonderful guest. Please welcome back to The Writer's Block, Ms. Chris Enns.
Wow. Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. I hope that I won't underwhelm you.
Well, no, you never do, Chris. You never, never, ever do. And I would like to emphasize that you are the president of WWA, because, of course, I am a member, and I bow to you.
Whoa.
Oh, well, you enchanté, sir. So, good.
I like it.
Well, I'm glad that you're a member. It's a wonderful organization. It's been around for more than 60-plus years. And, you know, I mean, it's everything that we can do to promote literature of the American West. We have a, right. wonderful program. Our convention is coming up in June. It's going to be in Loveland, Colorado, so I hope that you can come and be a part of the festivities.
I always say I'm going to, and then I never do. I don't know. I don't know what's going on there. But
I do. You're a flake, Jim.
As long as you're definitely.
I mean, I just became. I'm no longer an associate member. I'm now a full member. So I mean, you know. So I'm pretty happy with that. So there you go.
Okay.
Book, Iron Women, the ladies who helped build the railroad. What a story. I mean, well, it's obviously many stories, but what a great, great premise. Because apparently there were just a lot of women that had a lot to do with the railroads, and they never really got the recognition that they deserved.
Well, you know, it was really funny. When the the Transcontinental Railroad met up in Utah in 1869, they made a big issue about the fact that there were no women that had a hand in surveying the land or laying any of the track. And they wanted everybody to recognize that because this was at a time in the Wild West when women were pushing for suffrage. And a lot of men didn't necessarily believe that women should have the right to vote because they didn't help advance the country. But they were oh so wrong. I mean, they were able to put together the train. The track and the Transcontinental Railroad from one part of the country to the next. But in order to make railroad travel attractive, in came the women. I think men would have been happy with just, okay, we got the shell of the vehicle done. Let's just put up a couple of barrels and a plank of wood and people can sit there. But when you do that, there weren't a lot of people that wanted to travel the rails. And you had a host of women come in and make travel attractive. They invented a variety of things that would be used in making train travel safe and, as I said, comfortable. And, I mean, I think the book really should be called, instead of women who helped build the railroad, it should be really women who influenced the railroad.
Because
some of these women, some of these women really did have their hand in helping to build what took place on the railroad. And then other women had a hand in influencing them. One of the stories in the book is about Laura Bullion. She was a member of the Wild Bunch gang, and she had a hand in helping to rob the last train that was robbed in the United States. That was Laura Bullion. And
right.
She influenced the railroad travel because prior to her helping to rob the train, women's handbags were never searched. So thank you, Laura Bullion, for really issuing in what we now know as the TSA. So we have a
hurricane. See, all this time I thought it was. All this time, I thought it was 9/11 and the Trade Centers, and it was Laura Bullion all the time.
Right back with her. Yeah.
And she, of course, was a soiled dove at Fanny's place in San Antonio, Texas.
She was. I mean, I guess they make the best train robbers or the best outlaws because, you know, I mean, she was with Etta Place, and there were just a handful of those women who really had a position within the no pun intended, a position within the stage of the Wild Bunch, and
right.
The most recognized, of course, are Etta Place, Sundance Kid's gal, and
right.
Laura Bullion, who was right. with Kirkpatrick. So
I'm just curious.
Ben Kirkpatrick. Yeah,
the photograph of Laura Bullion that you have in there. She's dressed like a man, and she's got her hair at least pulled back. It looks like it's short. Anything to that?
Well, I don't know necessarily if it's dressed like a man. It's the look of that particular time period. It's now she was, when you imagine that she ends up in her life being a seamstress for department stores helping to make clothing. So she really didn't, she just made them. She just didn't, I think all you can see really is from the shoulders up.
Pretty
but
much,
really,
yeah.
That was a very much the uniform at the time. I mean, she's wearing really what it is. It's a tailored jacket with a nice tailored shirt and a tie that a lot of women wore back then. This was in the 1920s, 1930s, and she had a skirt on with that. So. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
She just looks hard because, you know, she'd had a rough life.
And isn't it true that they in the photographs that nobody smiles? They thought that was if they smiled, there was something wrong. I think there was an association with the devil or something. I forgot what I had read about that. But nobody smiles.
Well, in the research that I have done, a lot of people didn't smile because they had bad teeth. I mean,
right.
Dental hygiene was not something that anybody practiced. So, you know, in all of my pictures, I try not to smile either, but it's not because of bad teeth, but just because I have a lazy eye. No matter what you do, if you smile, you get that one eye that just really completely closes. And, you know, people look at the photo and then say, there's something wrong with that poor woman.
So, right. And
bless
and
her
also,
heart.
Also, it took 10 seconds to take the picture. So, I mean, to hold a smile for 10 seconds, it was easier just to keep a straight face.
Right. I mean, there were so many different things that went into having your photograph taken at that particular time period. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. But just, I don't know that Laura had a whole lot to smile about anyway. I mean, you spend 5 years in prison, and it was a really rough prison that she was at. And, you know, then you get out, and you go back with Ben, who, you go with Ben again after he spent, I think it was 10 years. He didn't do the whole stretch. Maybe it was 12. Maybe he got 15 and he just served 12. But she waits for him all that time. And then when he gets out, he doesn't change his ways at all. He goes right back into robbing banks. So, you know, she changes her name and goes to a bigger market and works for a department store as a seamstress for women's dresses.
Right. You know, I was amazed, and I don't know how you felt, Russ, but I was amazed when I first started reading the book and I got into the telegraphers and how important that the women were as telegraphers throughout the railroad lines. I mean, virtually. There was almost like a woman in every office along the railroad line, and it just amazed me that they used women as telegraphers and freed the men up to go hammer spikes into the rails, I guess, is what they did.
Well, I mean, what was really important about that, the women, in order to really be tried and tested, to be the women at the desk transferring the messages from the railroad to the people who ran the crossings and making sure everything was all right. I mean, they would have to listen to these messages and really decipher what is what. And in order to be trained to be really top at your job, you'd have maybe four or five different telegraph machines going at the same time.
Right.
You'd have to decipher which one. You'd have to key in to which one that you wanted to, that you had to really focus on. And, you know, and there was the telegraph that printed out different, like a little ticker tape with the information on it. And you could do that. That was the easy way of doing it. But the difficult way is to be able to know Morse code and be able to write out everything like
transcribe.
That.
Transcribe. So, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So these ladies were brilliant. I mean, the other thing that I found absolutely fascinating about it, how many women entertainers there were up and down the line working as telegraph operators. And they would work at telegraph operators, and in the evenings they would go and perform at different clubs with songs and singing and dancing, and how some of them were even working with, I think the woman's name was Maddie. Maddie was one of the telegraphers that was working in the Sparks, Reno area. And she travels all over the country working her trade. But in a couple of places that she went to, she's working with a cowboy artist who is really more focused on being a cowboy singer than he is his job, and doesn't do too well at his job. And that was Gene Autry. Mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty amazing. Gina,
yeah, you know, something else you mentioned in the book, too, about Maddie is that she was one of the ones, I mean, she realized early on that she wasn't getting the same pay that the men were.
Right.
She knew that she was as good, if not better, than the men, and that she actually went in and demanded to get paid more, and they gave her a test, and sure enough, she proved herself and got the equal pay. But
she maxed it.
Yeah, but you know what? That's still the same. It's still the same struggle that women are going through today. And something else you mentioned too, Chris, is that you know that women during the time when they were trying to get the vote, and that the men felt that they shouldn't have the vote because they were not really helping the country move forward like the men were. As in with the railroad.
Some men thought about. Some men thought that. Not all men. I mean, I got to tell you, I don't necessarily subscribe to. Yeah, in this particular instance with Maddie, she was somebody that wasn't getting paid what she should, and she proved herself that she could. And there were some instances, of course, where men, certainly women, realized being able to vote out west before women in the east were able to. I don't necessarily subscribe to the idea that that men went out of their way to make sure women weren't paid as much. A lot of men, especially during the railroad times, they all they knew was manual labor. They weren't going to be able to compete in anything else. So, you know, you're not going to have any of those guys laying track with big meaty hands coming in and running any of the telegraph operating systems.
And you weren't going to have a lot of the women that were out, you know, hammering the spikes in either.
You absolutely were not. And so, you know, being able to look at, I think I've shared with you guys, you know, I mean, I'm also a private investigator. And the cases that I take are generally the men who are falsely accused of child molestation. And, you know, that's an area that I see a lot of women saying people did something that they didn't do. And really, really putting men in a place that they don't need to be and that they don't deserve to be. So I look at this from a whole different aspect. A lot of times when you're talking about the history of the American West, people will say, well, it's called history. It's not called herstory. And that's because men wrote history. Well, the men who were, to say that the really top-notch historians purposely left women out is like saying the really top-notch scientists left particular chromosomes out. They wouldn't have done that. A lot of the men out west, there weren't a lot of women, a lot of historians out west at the early start of the frontier, there weren't a lot of women. So they were not going to write down the women that they did meet, which were mostly soil doves. You're not going to put that down in any history book.
Right.
You know, hey, discovered gold and last night spent the evening with a really wonderful hooker. You're not saying that in any history book.
Right, right.
And you too, huh?
And they well, you know, Russ, they used to call them flatbackers.
Yeah.
Which is a great term. I mean, it's very derogatory, but it's kind of conveys the point.
Yeah, very descriptive.
and you read Maddie's, you read the whole chapter about Maddie. I mean, Maddie was married like 7-8 times.
Right.
Maddie went through men like Kleenex. You know,
she could stay married more than a couple, 2-3 years at a time. Yeah,
she did not. She was always pregnant, leaving the guy, getting a divorce, going to a different place. A lot of times, I mean, especially when it comes to today, I mean, a lot of times it was that way back then, too. When men were going for a job, especially some of these men who became the head of the telegraph operating stations, they were men who were willing to sacrifice having a family and children and a wife and children. They were able to sacrifice that for their job. A lot of women aren't able to sacrifice that or willing to sacrifice that.
Right.
So
right.
Men recognizing they can't have it all and moving up the chain, I don't think that can be compared to women who aren't willing to give that up and expect to get paid the same. I don't know. That's just my.
I don't know that women were always given the opportunity to prove themselves. I mean, even with Maddie, that she went into that, she had gone into that one office, I forgot where it was, and She walked in and the guy says, what are you doing here? She says, well, I'm here for a certain shift or something. He says, we don't hire women. What the heck's wrong with you? I mean, that's pretty tough. And there were not a lot of women who were willing to stand up to that.
And I'm not saying that didn't exist. Certainly that does exist. Certainly that does exist. You're absolutely right. And in Maddie Coon's example, that's correct. I'm sorry, Maddie Bright's. That was her name. There's a lot of Maddies in this book. It was Maddie Bright. But I think by and large, there were, it's why I just loved writing about this book. So many women did amazing things. I mean, it wasn't just the women that were the telegraph, it's so hard to say telegraphers, but the telegraph operators, you know, it was people like Mary Pennington, who was a scientist, who ends up inventing the modern day refrigerator car, you know, and because of her effort, we were able to feed the nation during World War I, getting produce from one end of the country to the next part of the country.
Sure.
And you know, she invented what she did. And I love, there's a great picture in the book of her on top of, the refrigerator car, testing it.
Right. Yeah. I think she's putting ice in there, wasn't she, or something? But anyway.
But I mean, she writes on the top of that for a while. And I just was so impressed with her. I mean, it's not glamorous stuff. It certainly isn't Lily Langtry's story about the Lali. It certainly isn't Miriam Leslie, who is my absolute favorite chapter in the book. But, you know, Dr. Mary Pennington, she's doing some real important work. And like I said, I mean, she's conducting experiments on top of refrigerator railroad boxcars, traveling from one part of the country to the other. And I just admire that so much.
Yeah. We're going to take a real quick break here, so don't go away, Chris. Russ, stay right where you are. This is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block. And right now, we're going to hear a real brief word about LA Talk Radio.
Hi, Jim Christina here for LA Talk Radio. And you know, in these days of coronavirus and COVID-19, as you're sitting home at your desk doing your job, how about instead of watching reruns of Lassie and the Lone Ranger, you tune in to www.latalkradio.com and listen to what our hosts have to say during the day. We've got everything from sports to music to self-help to, well, we even have talk. So why not give us a try during the day? latalkradio.com. And remember, every Thursday night, 6 p.m. Pacific, right here on LA Talk Radio, is The Writer's Block. Have a great day.
And we are back. It is now, 6:20. And we are talking to Chris Enns in Grass Valley, California. She is the author of just a terrific book about women in the road and all women, all things Western. And if you want to call and talk to Chris, the number here in the studio is 323-302-0815. And if you didn't get that, it's 323-302-0815. And Russ?
Yes, sir.
I am absolutely thrilled. And I'm absolutely thrilled that Chris is here with us.
Again. I am too. I mean, Chris, you're the epitome of the best guest.
The quintessential guest.
You are. But, you know, a couple of things. I just want to make comment, first of all, for anybody who's thinking about reading this book. It is so different than what you might think when you read the title.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
When I picked this up to read it or put it up on my Kindle, I'm thinking, okay, so I'm going to read about these women who are out there in the trenches with these guys laying the rails for the railroad. And it's not that at all. And I was amazed at the infrastructure that was needed all around the railroad and how important a part, as Jim said earlier, that the women played in this. And the other part of it I want to say is that you did such a nice job in your research, and you made this, the account of these women's lives, so much more intimate than I would have thought. I really enjoyed learning about them. I mean, I feel like I kind of know them.
Right. After reading each chapter, which is based on a particular separate woman, you really do come away with some kind of a knowledge and feeling like you do know these women. Just, I mean, even just a little bit. It's just really terrific the way you've written them, Chris, and your style of writing is phenomenal to start with. And I have a comment here I want to make. And not only do we have Laura Bullion, who is, of course, a soil dove and a bank robber and a train robber, but we also have a very famous prostitute from Virginia City, Julia Bulett.
Yes.
And, and Julia, I actually was in Virginia City a couple times and went by her old crib and then out to the graveyard in the cemetery where she's buried. And it's kind of she got a wonderful gravestone. I mean, I think all the men in town pitched in money to bury her because her tombstone is huge. It really is. And it's really very, very ornate for a hooker at the time, a trollop, a flatback, or whatever you wanted to call her. But she was not just your ordinary prostitute, was she, Chris? She was
No, she was not. And she was so so beloved in Virginia City. I mean, that's what set her apart from everything. I mean, that's why her tombstone is so cute. That and the fact that she was murdered in such a brutal fashion by some drifter that came into town. And, she helped out the fire department. I mean, she was a big supporter of the fire department. And that's why everybody just thought she was a soiled dove with a heart of gold. And you hear that often thrown around, but I think if that particular handle was ever to be attributed to anybody correctly, it would be Julia Bulett. She just had that about her. She was charming. She was kind to people. Whereas other people might shun the soiled doves, she was celebrated. And I think the fact that they have that train, the special V&T Railroad Club coach named for her.
Right,
car number runs, 8. Yeah, number 8, I remember it, yeah.
That still runs back and forth. I think that's a real wonderful tribute to who she was. And like I said, I mean, that because she was helped with the fire department and was a mascot for the fire department, and a lot of the fires that they put out happened to be associated with a railroad, I think it's fitting that they named a car for her and that she influenced the railroad in that way. Like I said, I mean, it would be disingenuous to say that she helped build the railroad, but she did influence it in that particular sphere of her influence.
So I'm curious. I'm curious to know, is that this car number 8 that's still running, and I wonder if there's any if there's anything that people are trying to do on this car, like you know, there's the Mile High Club, and this would be her car number 8.
Well,
join the Juliet Bulett Club.
Yes.
I don't think so, but can you absolutely imagine that? Because it really is. It runs from Virginia City into Carson City and then back again, and usually it's set up for it's a family event, you know. So I guess if you were the person giving the tours, it's a real education for the little ones. You know, if they don't know the birds and the bees, this is the day you need to saddle up and learn everything that you can about it, kids.
Good choice of words.
Not only
saddle
about
up.
Being a,
a plaque in that train car. There is a plaque commemorating what it's named after or who it's named after.
I don't know how much in detail they go about. You know, I mean, I don't even. A lot of times, if you say soil doves, people are like, "What is that?"
It's basic, but it's really nice. It's on one of the bulkheads towards the door, and it's just. I mean, the train car itself is as it was in the 1880s or 1870s. It's just like an old wood seat Pullman car. I mean, there's nothing special about it, and very uncomfortable to sit in.
Right. And, you know, most of the trains were, I mean, I think that is a real good example to lead into how other women made train travel much more attractive and much more comfortable to get from point A to point B. Because that was what it was. I mean, if you had to sit on that and go from one part of the country to the next, it's so uncomfortable. And there were no bathrooms, you know, I mean, guys got a bucket, but women, that's just tough bananas. We'll stop somewhere for water, and then you do what you got to do then. But
Right. And then along comes Olive Dennis, who was a civil engineer who made train travel a lot easier for the women.
And isn't she a looker? Have you looked at that place?
I mean, you never want to sit next to her on a train, but by God, she made it comfortable, at least.
Yeah, she did. I mean, you know, the special lighting over the seat, the ventilation. I mean, if you can imagine how stagnant it was on the car and having to ride from point A to point B in this musty, stagnant car with people smoking and, you know, the smells. And she comes up with this, the ventilation that would make it a little bit more comfortable, the lighting, the seats that would kind of recline, just made it where, I mean, and helped out with being able to create bathrooms on a train that were comfortable as well.
Right.
So, you know, she was a kind of, they didn't really, if you look at her picture, you can tell why she wasn't allowed out of the office very much. She just had to stay there at her desk inventing as much as she could.
Well, I mean, she complained about the train car, so they put her in charge of redesigning them. Perfect job for her.
And she got up to the plate and did exactly the job that they hired her to do.
Exactly.
You wouldn't necessarily think about that when you think about women who put together they help build the railroad.
Right.
You don't think about the fineries that ladies have done. You know, and then you go from somebody like Olive Dennis to, I like the story in the book about the woman that never was, Phoebe Snow.
Phoebe Snow, yes.
Girl, you know?
Yes,
there
yes.
There was no Phoebe
yes.
Snow.
No.
But in order to get people to ride the trains and to make them think that this is really a very clean venture, they invented this Phoebe Snow. Who she was like the Barbie doll for the 1900s. If you look at her pictures, you know, men were just hoping to meet somebody that looked like that on the train.
Right. Who's beating the dog?
Not me. I have no dog.
Someone has arrived, and all the dogs are kind of letting us know.
Speaking of, Russ, you run a business in Fillmore, California named All Dogs Rule. Would you like to tell us a little bit about it?
I would. And I want to say, I hope this is something that we can look forward to maybe starting, this summer, I think might be a good time. Because, you know, there's going to be a time when, you know, you're leaving on vacation, you've purchased your tickets, the hotel reservations are confirmed, the mail delivery's been suspended. What about the dog? Well, All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepovers is the place your dog wants to be when they can't be with you. All Dogs Rule provides your best four-legged friend a place to run and play outside among orange trees and grass in a country setting. Your dog gets to be, well, a dog. All Dogs Rule offers additional services, including individualized playtime, personal walks, swimming sessions in the creek, and training. Visit All Dogs Rule on the web at alldogsrule.com or give them a call at 805-524-1100. And when your pup returns home, that smile on his face will leave you wondering whose vacation was better. That's All Dogs Rule.
That's right. And my dog spent a weekend there, and she came home and peed on the carpet. So there you have it.
Our training works really well.
Your training worked well. And I have to say, Russ also has a training business called Canine Logic. Mm-hmm. And you can find them at caninelogic.net on the web. And I have to say that if you're in or around Southern California and you want to train your pooch, this is the place to take them. Russ is a phenomenal trainer. He trains not only your dog, but he also trains you, which is far more important.
Especially
me, I know.
Difficult with
especially,
you, Jim, but that's okay.
Especially me, because I am difficult, but my dog learned very well. So,
yeah.
I mean,
hey,
she,
Chris, I
she catches the ball off the end of her nose.
Well,
yeah, that's
you
right.
What,
you showed me that. That was very cute. Hey,
what
Sarah,
would have been good
Sarah,
is
I'm sorry,
Russ,
Chris.
If
go
Russ
ahead,
had
please.
Been around to be able to train Lily Langtree's bear that she received from the judge. Because,
you mean the one they had chained up in the back of the car?
The one they had chained up and then gave to her when she finally rides the lolly into
oh
Texas.
Oh my God!
Yeah.
Oh my God! Well, boy, what a segue into the lolly and Lily Langtree. Now that's a story. Yeah. What a railroad car that is! I mean, it's really hard to imagine a railroad car that big that they told them, "Watch out for the rickety railroad bridges because you ain't gonna make it across." That car had to have weighed like 25 tons. It was so big and so lumbering and so many things on it. But
right.
Wow.
Definitely so many things on it. That's for sure. You know,
there was a kitchen.
Yeah,
it was just amazing.
It had a piano on it. I mean, she traveled with this full upright piano on it. So
it was like, wow. And I think you said in the start of her story that that train car ran her like $65,000 to build at that time.
Right.
Right. That'd be about almost close to $1 million to build car.
It was a gigantic amount of money to be able to do that. But, you know, if you're going to travel, if that's what you're going to do, if that's what you were going to do with your life.
Right.
You're going to want to go in style. You know, I mean, that would be the equivalent nowadays to celebrities having their own jet.
Right.
You know,
it made sense because she stopped along the way and did shows, she needed a place to stay. And it's much easier to stay in your own railroad car than it is to get a hotel every day.
Right. I love the whole the image of people said it bore a striking resemblance to Cleopatra's barge.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, when she would arrive in town, I mean, it was an event. People could see that car from so many miles away, and they would flock to the depot. So really, it paid for itself in terms of promotion for Lily.
Right.
Because knew Langtree was in town, and she was going to be able to do an amazing show. And, I mean, to have your railroad car have a name, a special name, you know.
Yeah, Lully.
Yeah, the Lully. So, and you know, and it was so ornate, you know, cobalt blue, which was her favorite color, leaves of golden lilies of embossed wreaths and golden lilies encircling her name. The roof was white, polished teak. I mean, she went all out. And then there's a picture in the book of the bathroom that she had.
Right.
A lot of people didn't have working restrooms in there. And so I included a photo of the working restroom and how there's a woman in the shot who's standing up combing her hair.
Right.
Because a lot of people thought, you know, gosh, she'd have to be really cramped in there. But this was a way to show, oh, no. This was very roomy.
It was.
Very roomy.
It was.
Yeah,
you know, it almost makes me think, and you know, why give it up here, Chris. I mean, give up the real truth. Don't you think hooking on the side when she was going through the country?
You mean Lily? Hooking on the side?
Yeah.
I don't think Lily needed to do that at all. I think Lily probably had a number of lovers.
I don't think she needed to.
I don't think Lily... yeah, I don't know. She was just absolutely too beautiful and didn't have to do that. I mean, I think she had probably a lot of lovers, but I think picking up tricks along the way is not something that she really had to do.
No. I mean, for fun. You never know.
Well, yeah, it'd have to be somebody pretty charming in order to do that. I mean, a lot of those guys that are standing around on the depot as you're coming back and forth looked a lot like Judge Roy Dean.
Well, she actually went there too, but he was already dead by then.
She did go there. She did go there, but you know, I mean, the judge wasn't—he wasn't a looker. But you know, Lily was known as one of the most beautiful women in the world. I think people still do recognize her as one of the most beautiful actresses that ever graced the stage.
There's some pictures of her that she's stunning, and there's some pictures of her that she's kind of ugly. So that's camera angle, though.
Well, and there's some pictures that I still look at her and I think, you know, I don't know why you didn't shave that stuff on the upper lip. You know, they have razors. You don't have to walk around like this, seriously. But, you know, I mean, she was known as a professional beauty. That's how she got her start. People would invite her to parties, and then poets and artists would... Poets would start writing poems about her, and artists would start doing sketches of her. And she was one of the very first pinup girls in history, because artists would do these sketches of hers who were at parties, and then they would go out and sell those sketches for a penny a sketch.
Right.
So.
Right. If you wouldn't mind, can we talk a little bit about Mary Colette, because our Coulter, because our Coder, Coulter, I guess it is, that because she, was, of course, was the architect for the restaurants, for the Harvey restaurant chain.
Yeah.
And she was the one that did all the decorating, and what a wonderful woman she was. And her work today still stands out.
Oh, yes. I mean, you can't go to the Grand Canyon and not be impressed with the structures that she created at the canyon,
right,
which were created to look like they were just part of the canyon, not anything where you were going to be struck by looking at it going, oh, there's a man-made structure.
Right.
It blends in. I mean, she was so brilliant. It blends in with the setting. And I mean, she was influenced a great deal by the Native Americans, and that you can see in so much of what she designed. But you know, talk about a man who was a businessman who was very aware of the influence, the positive influence women can have, and that was Fred Harvey.
Fred Harvey, yeah, for sure.
He had no fear about hiring women like Mary Coulter to come and do the work that she did and design the Harvey restaurants and design the depots and design the hotels. And what an amazing talent she was.
Right. Well, a lot of those hotels are still in operation.
They are.
And they really have not been restored or rebuilt. They are like they were originally when they were built. And it's amazing. That is a testament to an architect for sure.
Right.
So,
I mean, I was talking about the Grand Canyon. One of the pieces that she has at the Grand Canyon is called the Watchtower at Desert View. And if you look at it, you just go, "Oh my gosh, this looks like it's an ancient Indian ruin structure." But it's not. She did it like that on purpose, so as not to interfere with the landscape itself. I mean, and there's something very brilliant about that. She, if you go to the bottom of the canyon, there's a hotel. There's a hotel at the bottom of the canyon itself that she designed. But you have to be willing to make reservations way in advance to go stay there. And you're not getting back out of there. I mean, if you forget, oh my gosh, wait a second, I forgot toothpaste. You know, you're just going to have to live with toothpaste.
Yeah.
You're not getting out of there real quick. So.
No.
But,
no,
you know,
you're
the
not.
La Fonda Hotel. The La Fonda Hotel in Santa Fe is still standing. So, you know.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I mention, because we're almost running out of time here, and I wanted to ask about Sarah Kidder, because she ended up, I mean, as far as being running a railroad in the late 1800s, pretty unusual, I think.
It is very unusual. Again, that was a testament to, behind every great woman is a great man, and that was a testament to her wonderful husband, who believed her to be so bright and talented that that he sets it up in her will that she gets to run the railroad. And she is the first railroad president in the history of railroads, definitely in the West. And she makes the Nevada County Narrow Gauge Railroad a profitable venture for the entire 12 years that she serves as president. It had never made a profit before, and it didn't make a profit after she sold it off.
Right.
So it was called the 12 golden years that Kidder takes over.
Right. She was actually made enough money. She pulled it out of almost bankruptcy and made it highly profitable. In fact, she was paying dividends to the stockholders.
Yeah,
which
and
was
that was
the first time they ever got those. Right.
Just unheard of. But what an amazing woman. And, you know, I mean, before that, she's just known for hosting these incredible parties and her garden at her home. You know, she comes in and takes over this business. I mean, obviously, she was watching what her husband did, because he was a good businessman, too. And the whole while, too, she's fighting off. She's involved in lawsuits with a gentleman who said, I should get part of the funds from this railroad because I helped come up with it. So she's in a lawsuit. So can you imagine, you're a woman doing this job at this particular time period, you make it profitable, and you're involved in a lawsuit at the same time.
Right. Yeah. She was an amazing, amazing woman. In fact,
and to top it off,
book,
oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Bart.
I was just saying, to top it off, she lived to be 91 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. She lived in she died in San Francisco, from what I remember. Yeah. She just, she always stayed in Northern California. She loved it here. She had an adopted daughter. And you can't talk about women who influenced the American Railroad without mentioning Mrs. S. A. Kidder of Grass Valley, California.
Right. Now, her adopted daughter was her niece.
So they say. It's kind of some scuttlebutt about that too. But yes, Beatrice was her name. Yeah.
We'll take scuttlebutt.
Yeah.
We like scuttlebutt at this show. So,
yeah, I mean, she just kind of...
I did the same thing. I adopted my niece, so...
We'll see. There you go. I just thought... I thought that was really sweet, too. A lot of people, before she took over the railroad and she had Beatrice, people would see the two of them in town dressed alike because Sarah was an amazing seamstress and would make these amazing, ornate lace dresses for both of them. So...
Uh-huh.
Just a captivating character. A lot of these women in the book are captivating, though. You know, it's hard to know where to stop.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I mean, as I told you, they're
all interesting. Yeah, they're all interesting.
Marion Leslie is my favorite lady in the book. So.
Oh, really? We're going to take a real quick break. Hang on to that thought. And right now, you're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is, of course, the Writer's Block. And we're going to get a little word from Creative Edge.
Hi, Jim Christina from the Writer's Block here with some great big news. If you're an author or aspiring to be one, then you better check this out. Creative Edge, one of Canada's top boutique publicity firms for authors, is now expanding. They are dedicating themselves to promoting authors, indie and traditional, in all walks of life, all genres, and they're looking for all opportunities. Owned by Mickey Mickelson, Creative Edge has the passion, the contacts, and the knowledge to help authors and other artists build their brand and get their work noticed. You can contact Mickey at mickey.creativeedge@gmail.com to get started, or you can go to www.creative-edge.services. Creative Edge Publicity, it's your brand, it's your future.
And we are back. It is now 6:45. And we are on the phone with Chris Enns. And I have to say, real quick side, Mickey just now signed, or last week signed, I don't know how good your memory is, Chris or Russ. I know how good yours is. It's not.
Yeah, it's crappy, right.
Remember, back in the 60s or early 70s, there was a gal that did a song called I've Got the Roller Skates, You Got the Key. Melanie.
Melanie, sure.
Well, yeah. he just signed her for a publicity contract, so that's kind of cool. Anyway,
wonderful. Well, I'm glad that kind of thing exists, because authors need to be able to tap into something like that, because publishing house does nothing for you. Nothing.
Right.
They pay to have your book printed, and that's it. That's where they stop.
That's the sign of the times. I mean, what's the big publishing house that just got sucked up by Penguin Books? Simon and Schuster.
Yeah.
So they're gone. So, you know, now it's like three big publishers and that's it, which is why a lot of writers are going to the small boutique publishing houses, which is kind of cool. And it gives them more business and kind of lets the big guys know that, hey, you know what? You're not the only guys on the block. So,
well,
anyway,
I think as author, I think those kinds of things are crucial. So kudos.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. As an author, I think they are too. Real quick aside, the Harvey girls, of course, were Fred Harvey. They were, all of good. What do they call it? What did he say? Good moral, perpetuity or whatever it was,
right,
how they used
to
put it. And I had no makeup. Makeup during their work. They couldn't date people they worked with. They could date customers, but it was frowned on. I mean, they were the ones that everybody got off the train to go visit.
Right. As, major, well, as, well, Will Rogers said about them, they kept the West in food and wives.
There you go.
Yep. They were kind of like a mail order bride service too, because a lot of the women that signed on, they signed on because they were hoping to meet a husband out West. And
right.
some of the women wanted to bankroll some funds in order to get to college.
Right.
So, they signed contracts. You had to sign a contract with Harvey to work. You couldn't just say, yeah, I'll get the job. You signed a contract and
right.
you had to live up to that contract or you would be dismissed. And
exactly.
He was a smart guy. He was a very smart businessman. And women that took advantage of it were. And I think, didn't you have a relative?
Yeah, my wife's mother was a Harvey girl.
Okay.
She in Kansas City, and that's like as we talked about before the show. There, she was getting to work just as the parking lot exploded outside of Union Station at the big Kansas City massacre in 1933. So she got to watch the whole thing go down. It's kind of cool, actually.
Did she write about it? Did she write anything down about it?
She never did. She passed on the story. She was the cashier. She was allowed to get married. She still worked for Harvey. Wasn't allowed to wait on tables anymore. She had to, they only made her a cashier. So, she told her husband, and then of course the story got bigger and bigger as it went along. I never met the woman. She was gone long before Jerry and I ever met, but it was an interesting story.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, whenever anybody brushes up against with history like that, it's just absolutely fascinating. And
I
thought the story of the Harvey girls and the railroad hospitality ambassadors is what they were known as.
Right.
And I just think that they just the way they dressed, the way they carried themselves, it was a lot like Judy Garland's The Harvey Girls.
Right. Well, Chris, we are out of time, and I hate to
quickly.
It always does with you, and I'm gonna make arrangements to have you back. I mean, we're not even close to being done talking yet. So
well, that'll be good. I got a new book coming.
Anyway,
out.
You want to let your information? You do. Oh, good. Well, we're booked up through June.
Well, isn't that a lovely problem to have? My book comes out in August. My next one comes out in August. So
there you go. Book a date now.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, but people can learn all about my books by going on chrisentz.com.
Okay, and your email, you can get your email there, I assume.
Sure, that's G.
Chris at chrisentz.com. Okay.
Yeah,
and again, thank you so much for spending your evening with us. I mean, we know you have other options, and glad you chose us. And
thank you for calling in.
You're welcome, Chris, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Chris.
And next week we have, Philip Thompson, and his book is called Old Anger. It's kind of a modern Western, and we'll be talking to him, Bobby Jean and I. And Russ, thanks for popping in and joining us on the show tonight. Always appreciate it when you're around. Russ,
thank you for having me.
Are you there?
I'm here.
Oh. Hello. Anyway. Thank you so much for joining us. And as we say goodnight from, of course, Russ Avison and myself, Bobby Jean Bell, Ronan Rosner, and, of course, the wonderful Mr. Sam Paston and LA Talk Radio, we are out of here.